From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 4 years and change ago, Bitcoin was nothing. This week, talk of Bitcoin is all over Capitol Hill and far beyond. Virtual currency, cryptocurrency, frictionless digital money outside of government control for when dollars or euros or yen won't do. Online porn sellers and drug dealers have embraced it on the dark web, but so have people who sell socks. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says it may hold long-term promise for a faster, more secure, and more efficient payment system. This hour on Point, the world of Bitcoin. The Winklevoss twins may not own Facebook, but they're thinking a lot about Bitcoin, and they're into it. Last week, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, big investors in Bitcoin, talked with CNBC. Cameron here saying investing in Bitcoin has a lot of similarities with investing in gold.
People definitely view it as gold 2.0. And then there's also the technology aspect of just the idea that payments are going to increasingly use a network like the Bitcoin network to move money around the globe. But in terms of a store of value, it definitely has the properties of gold, and people are viewing it that way.
This week, Bitcoin is hot. Its last big blip in the headlines when Silk Road, the online emporium for sex and drugs, got busted. Hearings this week, a couple of them on Capitol Hill. Here was Monday. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee held a hearing on virtual currencies. Committee Chairman Senator Tom Carper of Delaware talked about illegal transactions that Bitcoin can be used for.
While Silk Road was perhaps the most well-known, if not the only marketplace where illicit goods are bought and sold through Bitcoin transactions, today a number of similar enterprises that accept Bitcoins are still in business, selling weapons, child pornography, and even murder for hire.
Senator Tom Carper joins us later in this hour. With us right now from New York is Andy Greenberg, technology, privacy, and information security reporter with Forbes, author of This Machine Kills Secrets, How WikiLeakers, Cypherpunks, and Hacktivists Aim to Free the World's Information. Andy Greenberg, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Also joining us from New York is Robin Seidel, senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. She's been all over the burgeoning market in Bitcoin. Robin Seidel, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Andy, why has this got so much attention all of a sudden?
Well, I think that there are two reasons. One is that Bitcoin's actual exchange rate with the dollar has been skyrocketing to unprecedented levels. I think this morning it started to fall just a little bit, but it's still higher than it's ever been before. So anyone who has held Bitcoins has gotten very rich very quickly. But the other reason is that we've seen this explosion of a kind of dark web economy where Bitcoin is used for, as you said, buying everything from drugs to guns to assassinations, as I recently reported. And one of those biggest marketplaces, the Silk Road, was recently taken down. And I think we saw in the process of that crackdown just how much it had accumulated. The alleged owner of that black market for drugs mostly had earned himself close to, I think of this right now with the exchange rate being where it is, or something like $80 million.
And that just in Bitcoin. Of course, that's skyrocketing value this week, Robin. I mean, you've got a chicken and egg thing here. It's partly because of all the attention. Two hearings on Capitol Hill this week. It gives it a sense of credibility. Ben Bernanke talking about Bitcoin. What about the value of this thing? Is there any intrinsic value?
Well, I think it's really hard to kind of figure that out right now. There are, you know, the price is skyrocketing, but there are also multiple exchanges that it's traded on, and the price is different on each exchange. So that makes it kind of confusing. But, you know, when you see the Treasury Department and Ben Bernanke and real venture capitalists putting real money into this, it certainly gives it an air of credibility.
But just from that angle, I mean, here, just this week it's been at 900, it's been at 500. You can see it was for a long, long time at 200. I mean, that kind of volatility makes one think that it's anything, everything, and maybe nothing.
Yeah, it's not for the faint of heart as an investor, that's for sure.
What kind of issues does it raise for nations? We'll look at the dark web application. But part of the concern in Washington this week is that you get into this crazy territory. I mean, Senator Mark Warner is saying, you know, it's if it becomes a standard currency or tool, it could radically and dramatically transform the role of central banks. He says, I'm only starting to wrap my head around the potential upside and downside of Bitcoin. There, Senator Warner, what are the implications of having a big cryptocurrency, virtual currency at work in the world, Robin?
Well, I think that's what people are trying to figure out. I mean, one of the reasons, another reason that there's been so much volatility and the price has gone so high is that there's growing interest in China from Bitcoin, about Bitcoin. And so that's propelling the price. You've got an exchange that's based in Slovenia that's gaining a lot of credibility. There's a new exchange that's in Singapore as well, and there's an exchange in China. So, I mean, I think the view is that there are different governments may think differently about it, and everybody's trying to wrap their arms around that because just because there is hesitation and a lot of concern in the U.S. about, you know, money laundering and things like that, other countries may be less concerned about those issues and more willing to embrace it, which then, of course, increases the concerns here.
I mean, what we're used to is fiat currency. The government says this is the currency, this is the dollar or the yen or the euro. And, you know, the U.S. at one time said there was gold behind it. And then just pure fiat. This is just the currency. This is not fiat currency. So why would a government like, I don't know, it's the government or just Chinese people? Who in China is going for it and why?
Well, I think it's the same people who are the same types of people who are here. And I think people there are certainly a group of people who are not comfortable with a government-backed currency for whatever reason that is, whether it's political views or because they want to do something with that, you know, currency that's not legal. So, I mean, there are just so many different factors that are really playing in here. And there are certain governments that have, you know, made determinations or said that, you know, we think that this there may be something here, just like our government is. I mean, the fact is, when you have the Treasury Department looking at it, issuing guidelines saying that this needs to follow money transmission rules, I mean, it becomes a lot more real.
Ben Bernanke saying, let's not step on this too hard. This was Monday, again, at the Senate committee hearing. This was Department of Justice Acting Assistant Attorney General Maithili Raman saying digital currencies offered legitimate financial services also come with risks.
At the Justice Department, we look at virtual currencies through the lens of criminal law enforcement. We recognize that virtual currency systems can be a legal means of exchange, but we also recognize that criminals will always seek to take advantage of new technologies to commit, further, or hide their crimes.
Andy Greenberg, take us back to basics. I mean, just very basics, because a lot of people have never had anything to do with Bitcoin. What is it? How does it work?
Well, the Winklevoss twins describe it as digital gold, but I would say it's more like a kind of digital cash. And in the same way as cash, it can be kind of put in a suitcase and handed off. Bitcoin is a digital currency that's not issued by any government or any bank. So it doesn't necessarily have to be tied to any identities. And like cash, it can be anonymous.
Who does issue it? Where does it come from?
Well, essentially, it's actually created in this kind of process where thousands of people who are using Bitcoin, all of their computers are running this algorithm. And there's a kind of lottery that happens where every hour or so, some number of Bitcoins are produced, and those are given to somebody to kind of in a random way to whoever has won this kind of cryptographic lottery by showing that they have the most computing power. And this is called the process of mining. It's
mining is essentially solving math, very complex math problems, right?
Right, yeah. The way that the mysterious creator of Bitcoin, who is known as Satoshi Nakamoto, nobody knows who this guy is.
Satoshi Nakamoto. It's great.
Yeah, that's a great pseudonym. Yeah. And the way that he designed this is that essentially everybody who's in the Bitcoin network competes to show that they have the most computing power. Mm-hmm. And if you can sort of win this lottery by generating proof of work, they call it, then you win the Bitcoins for that hour.
Is that sort of like the Fed sliding $1 billion into a bank's, you know, to pump the money supply?
Yeah, but the difference is that it happens in a way that is totally locked in. There's a rate of Bitcoin production that can't be changed. There's a graph over the next, 27 years about how many Bitcoins will be created, then nobody can change that.
Okay, so instead of pick and shovel for gold, you've got computer power and a path that we're on here. It gets out there. How does it end up in your hands? You want some Bitcoin. How do you get it, Andy?
Well, the interesting thing is that there is no such thing as a Bitcoin in this physical sense. You can't find it on your hard drive either. In fact, it's sort of like the entire network of Bitcoin users agrees okay, Andy is going to be given a Bitcoin. Andy is going to give Tom his Bitcoin.
But you can also buy it. That's the whole point. If it's worth $900 per Bitcoin, somebody's buying it somewhere.
Right. So you would give me $900, and then I declare that I'm giving you my Bitcoin, and everybody agrees. And yep. It's recorded in this public ledger called a blockchain. The blockchain is copied around, you know, to every Bitcoin user's clients, their computers. And as a result, it's really difficult to forge any kind of Bitcoin transaction because everyone is tracking it. So in a way, Bitcoin is very private, but in a way, it's also extremely transparent because everybody can check these transactions and see who has Bitcoins.
This issue of anonymity is huge. Robin, you're with the Wall Street Journal. Are Wall Street guys, you know, stacking up Bitcoin fortunes here, betting on its future?
They sure are. They're trying to figure out how. I was speaking with someone who told me that, you know, everybody he knows at Goldman Sachs is trying to figure out how they can make money at this. I mean, that tells you everything right there.
This is just wild. We're going to dive right on in. We're talking this hour about Bitcoin and virtual currencies in the spotlight, digital money, and all the issues that come with it. Robin Seidel is with us from The Wall Street Journal. Andy Greenberg from Forbes. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, virtual currencies, in the spotlight this week with a couple of hearings on Capitol Hill looking at digital money and the issues that come with it. Andrew Greenberg is with us from Forbes. Robin Seidel is with us from the Wall Street Journal. We'll hear later in this hour from Senator Tom Carper of Delaware, who led one of the hearings this week. At Monday's Senate hearing, Jeremy Allaire, chairman and CEO of the Circle Internet Financial Group, said Bitcoin holds enormous promise.
I'm here to testify because I believe that digital currency represents one of the most important technical and economic innovations of our time. Specifically, digital currency introduces advancements in electronic payments and money transfers, potentially materially lowering costs for businesses around the world, decreasing fraud risk for consumers and merchants, increasing consumer privacy, and expanding the market for consumer financial products on a worldwide basis.
Great thing. Here we go. Let's invest, they say. Andy Greenberg, lots of feedback from our listeners here on Twitter. KB says, we got Kristen here first on Facebook, says, my boyfriend mines for Bitcoins, uses them in online transactions. KB says, if Bitcoin weren't available, cash would still be used for illegal items, murder for hire. I see no difference. What is the range of things that Bitcoin is now? Leave investment aside for a minute, Andy. What's it being used for in buying and selling transactions?
Well, I think that that comment is true, that Bitcoin is used for all the same things as cash. The thing is that it's used on the internet. This is internet cash. In fact, cash has never really existed on the internet before. We've had things like PayPal, but those have always been tied to an identity. The thing is that you can use Bitcoin with just an address that nobody can tie to your identity, and therefore it is being used for all kinds of things like buying drugs, buying murder, buying guns. These things are happening. I'm not saying that those are, in fact, even the majority of Bitcoin transactions. When the Silk Road black market was taken down, in fact, the price of Bitcoin rose. It didn't fall. So it's probably
and Silk Road sold only in Bitcoin, as I recall.
That's correct, right. And that was a way to protect not only the users of the site but the administrators as well. They could collect their fees and nobody knew who they were.
So there's drugs and there's guns. What about on the little less dark web side of things? Are there, you know, sort of everyday upright things that people are buying with Bitcoin? Like what?
Absolutely. I mean, you can use Bitcoin to buy anything, really. I mean, electronics or socks or alpaca, sushi, or there are lots of restaurants that accept Bitcoin now. And lots of people do see Bitcoin just as a more efficient, lower transaction cost kind of digital payment system that's better than PayPal, for instance. PayPal often seizes people's accounts. And so Bitcoin can be used for things that are considered controversial but may not be illegal, such as WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks accepted Bitcoin donations, for instance, they were denied the use of PayPal and other kinds of traditional banking tools.
Robin, why would anybody use this? I mean, to sell your sushi when you don't know what it's going to be worth tomorrow. It could be worth $900 for Bitcoin or $500 or $200.
Well, that's exactly it. It's a bet. And I think, you know, people are using it really for the novelty's sake. A lot of people, I was in San Francisco a couple of months ago and was at a cupcake bakery, and the owner there accepted payment for cupcakes in Bitcoin. So that's a far cry from murder and drugs. But I think it's the novelty. Lots of times these people, merchants who are accepting Bitcoin are also Bitcoin enthusiasts. They have their own stash of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. They want to hold on to it. I mean, I was talking to the owner of the Cupcake Bakery and she said, you know, I have this Bitcoin. I don't know what it's going to be worth, but that's no different than the cocoa that I use for my ingredients. I don't know what that's going to be worth because those prices go up and down as well.
That's just wild. And of course, at the really dark end, Andy, you've got this assassination market where people are essentially betting with Bitcoin on the assassination of different prominent figures around the world. I mean, and we're talking right at the top of the U.S. government and not only the U.S. government, France, Finland. You can kind of place a bet on who could be assassinated when, and the payoff would be in Bitcoin?
That's right. I just wrote about this earlier this week. It's a kind of crowdfunding site for murder, and it's funded through Bitcoin. So anybody can donate a certain amount of money in Bitcoin and put it on the head of a politician, and the murderer of that politician, if they can, once they prove essentially through a kind of clever cryptographic process that they were the killer, they receive all of those Bitcoins. So right now, there's almost $75,000 riding on the head of Ben Bernanke, for instance, the enemy number one of many Bitcoin users.
Talk about a dark web. That's about as dark as it gets. We're going to talk to an economist in just a moment about third world use of this and more. Let's go to our listeners. Richard in Providence, Rhode Island. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, basically, first of all, I want to straighten some things out that you guys have been saying. I wrote a couple of books about the dark web and Bitcoins. Actually, my book is The Deep Dark Web.
Let's hear it. What have you got?
What I got. Okay, first of all, Bitcoins came because of WikiLeaks. When WikiLeaks took Bitcoins, that's what started the Bitcoin coin rolling. That's what made it valuable. Now, before that, it was an underground currency. Only hackers had it. Now, today, what I'm worried about is the theft of Bitcoin wallets. That's a problem that no one's really talking about. I mean, Bitcoin has been criminalized by the bankers.
Yeah.
Let's face it. Visa, MasterCard, they all make, what, 3-4%? Bitcoin, a couple of pennies. You got your transactions instantly. So
they don't like it, at least not so far, but there's a lot of talk about people going for it. Richard, I appreciate your call. What about it, Andy? Who's going to ride shotgun on Bitcoin? Who's going to protect it against theft? And I mean, fiat currency, libertarians might not like it, or the Fed, but you know, who do you run to when somebody steals your Bitcoin?
Well, it's the same answer as what happens when somebody steals your cash. You know, there's a reason you don't put all of your money under your mattress. And I think that people need to realize that with Bitcoin as well, that it can be stolen. I mean, this is not simply a digital account that's off in the cloud somewhere. This is an actual kind of digital cash that's on your computer. If you lose your computer, if you lose the keys to control your Bitcoins, they're gone.
But if I lose, if my cash is stolen, that's a crime. Is it a crime to steal my Bitcoin?
I think so. I mean, it clearly has value. It's being recognized by regulators. In fact, there are all kinds of cyber criminal schemes to steal Bitcoins now. And I think the Bitcoin users definitely need to be aware of that. And it kind of came as a shock early on in the Bitcoin economy when this kind of crime arose. But now people need to be aware. And by now, most people are encrypting their Bitcoins and protecting them on their computers.
Robin, what about the security side of Bitcoin? Our caller says, watch out for theft, hacking here.
Well, sure. I mean, I think as Andy said, that's certainly a concern anywhere. But, you know, the SEC charged a Texas man earlier this year with running a Bitcoin Ponzi scheme in which he took donations from people and promised them a crazy interest rate, daily interest rate, I think it was, or a weekly interest rate. And they charged him, and he's facing charges. So, you know, whether or not anybody has made the determination about the official determination about what Bitcoin means and the value of it, I mean, a Ponzi scheme is a Ponzi scheme, and the authorities are going to go after people who use it in a way that's, you know, illegal or just, you know, not the way it's supposed to be used.
Wow, new world. Alex in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Alex, you're on the air. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I used Bitcoins to buy mushrooms from the Silk Road about a year and a half ago.
Like trippy mushrooms?
Yes.
Okay.
And I thought the process was kind of complicated. I had to send my money to probably three different online banking websites, and it was hard.
You mean to convert it into Bitcoin?
Yes, I had to go through Dwolla, then some British banking website, and I had to give a lot of these people my personal private info, and some of that kind of worried me.
Yeah, so much for anonymity if that's the path to get the Bitcoin. Alex, let us hold that thought and turn, if I may, to Susan Athey. She's professor of economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. Susan Athey in Stanford, California, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
We're talking about the Bitcoin as efficient, but there's a caller in Wisconsin who says, well, it wasn't that efficient for him. It was a lot of work just to get his hands on it, Susan.
That's right, and I had similar experiences the first time I got some dollars into Bitcoins. The problem today is that there aren't U.S. banks that are serving as on-ramps. They're a little bit nervous about entering the Bitcoin ecosystem. And until we get some more regulatory clarity, that's going slowly. So as a result, if U.S. people might be wiring money to a bank in Japan or Slovenia in order to get their dollars into Bitcoin. Once they're there, it's very easy to use. But getting into the Bitcoin economy is still not very easy.
We're reading about significant pickup in use of Bitcoin in developing countries, developing economies. Why would it have a particular attractiveness there, Susan?
Well, you have to remember that in most developing countries, people don't have bank accounts. On the other hand, many African countries are on the cutting edge of using technology for banking. A third of the Kenyan economy takes place using cell phone credits as a medium of exchange rather than physical currency. It works great because as long as you have a cell phone, you can store money there and you can send credits from phone to phone as a means of transaction. So that's allowed a lot of people to enter the financial sector that really didn't have access otherwise. The big problem is that the fees are large. Cashing out of this system can cost as much as 20 to 25% if you're just cashing out small amounts, and that's not so great for people in poverty.
So is there big pickup of this in Kenya and beyond? What are people using it for?
Well, so it's an alternative to these cell phone-based systems. The cell phone-based systems are national, so they work within borders. But you think about remittances. We've got $400 to $500 billion a year coming from people working abroad and sending money back to their families, very often very poor families. And the fees for those remittances can be in the 7 to 9% range or even higher, again, if you're sending small amounts. So there's a lot of potential here for people to quickly and easily move money across borders. Right now, it's still hard because of the on-ramp problem. You know, it's hard to get money into the system. But if you do have a local retail establishment that would take your local currency and put it into Bitcoin, and the person on the other end has a way to get it out, you can send money instantly, small amounts, and if somebody needs money urgently at home just to get groceries for dinner, get be able to pay off a debt where somebody's called collecting at your door, you're able to do it instantaneously without losing a large chunk of it to remittance fees.
So step back here as an economist, Susan. We're going to hear from Senator Tom Carper in a minute, but Senator Warner was asking this week about money supply. If this really takes off and you've got cryptocurrency, virtual currency outside the realm of fiat currency sponsored by governments, what does this or could this mean for national money supplies, global money supplies, the way the whole big economy works?
Well, I think for a country like the United States, we're just a long, long, long way away from this having a big effect. I mean, the overall value of the Bitcoin market last week was like $2 billion. Now, okay, so it goes up to, you know, $8 billion, depending on the price of the currency at the moment. But this is just not enough. That's worldwide. This is just not enough
to really
matter. A speck
in the trillions.
Yeah, and so, you know, if and when it actually got big enough, there's a lot of levers that a government could pull. If it turned out that this was really a much more efficient way to do transactions, you know, governments might issue their own virtual currencies. There's no reason to think that it would be Bitcoin per se. There's a lot of advantages for people, especially everyday people who aren't speculating, to be holding their local currencies. It's how they pay taxes and so on. So the government's always going to have a big advantage in a country like the United States, where our currency is relatively stable. Now, you could see, just like, you know, in some developing countries, that alternatives crop up to the local currency. And there's a lot of countries where people use a lot of U.S. dollars because of worries about inflation and so on. So, you know, it could cause some more fundamental changes in countries that already have problems with their currency. But in the U.S., it's so far away from mattering that I really don't think that that's the most important consideration right now.
People certainly watching it. We're talking about Bitcoin. Michael in Framingham, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. What I'm wondering is, my understanding of conventional currency is that it's not just given away, it's all lent out. And it gets its value from the fact that once you receive a loan, you have to produce something of value that you can sell so you can pay your loan back. It sounds like the Bitcoin is more like winning a lottery. All of a sudden, somebody gets a bunch of money on their computer, and I don't understand how that can relate to any value because you didn't have to really do anything to get that money.
Economist Athey, what do you say to Michael's question?
Sure. So I think that's not really the right way to think about what this these things are. This is a technology for moving value, for moving money from one person to another. Fundamentally, it's a public ledger. So if I want to send you money, I can't just beam you a physical dollar and have it appear in your hand. Something has to move somewhere, and in math-based currencies, there's a public secure ledger. And if I send you money, a chit or a coin or a mark in the book, you can call it whatever you want, moves from me to you.
We get the ledger part, but what about the value part? The Winklevi say it's like gold. You can dig it out of a mountain or dig it out of an algorithm in this case. But our caller's saying, well, how does that make sense?
So I think, some of the follow-ons just have a fixed supply. So another, an alternative, Ripple is an example. They just have a fixed supply. I think it's a red herring to worry about the mining. The value of it has to do with how often it's used.
Yeah.
So if a Bitcoin can be used, a single Bitcoin can be used, six times a day, and we want to do, $6 billion worth of transactions, then the total Bitcoin market value has to be $1 billion to support that volume of transactions. Mm-hmm. So really, when I think about the value of a Bitcoin, it has to do with its use. I'm sending money to you, and I need a Bitcoin to do it. I've got to buy one. If lots of people want to buy Bitcoins at the same time to send money to other people, the price goes up because the Bitcoins do take some time to move from one person to another. It's the concept of velocity in our regular economy.
So
if you think the transaction volumes are going to grow, then the value of Bitcoin should grow, and you can understand the recent run-up in prices as people thinking, well, gee, a lot of people are going to use this in China. If we get three times the volume of transactions, the price of the
up
exchange rate for Bitcoin should go up.
Exactly. I've only got you for another minute. Why would Ben Bernanke be more or less welcoming this week? A lot of anti-Fed people out there have been very enthusiastic about Bitcoin. Why would Ben Bernanke say, well, okay, let's watch this. It might be useful.
Well, he realizes, first of all, that it's not really a threat to the U.S. dollar, and it won't be anytime soon. And if we don't welcome it in the U.S., then it's just going to move offshore where it's much harder to regulate and we have less control. So having it be on the books and public and legitimate in the U.S. is a better outcome for the United States economy.
Do you own any?
I sold most of mine this week, but I kept a few just for fun.
Wow. It's good to be an economist and know when Bitcoin is at, whatever, $900. Congratulations on catching a wave this week. Susan Athey at Stanford, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Greenberg, just a few seconds before the break. Is it anonymous or not, Andy?
Well, it can be. If you use it the right way, it can be anonymous. And that's the thing. It has to be laundered in a sense, but that is possible. It can be used anonymously.
Andy talked with Dread Pirate Roberts, the guy who was at the helm of Silk Road. We'll ask about that. We'll hear from Senator Tom Carper, who had a lot of questions about Bitcoin on Capitol Hill this week. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bitcoin and virtual currencies, cryptocurrencies. Lots of feedback online, Robin. Andy James says, Bitcoin, all the cryptocurrencies, manifestations of a loss of confidence in sovereign fiat currencies, says Bitcoin isn't gaining in value. The U.S. dollar is becoming weaker in relation to the perceived value of Bitcoin. On the other hand, Gullwes says Bitcoin has a dark side that cash can never have because it moves at the speed of the net. That is a very scary proposition. The fact that it's largely unregulated makes it even more frightening. Chris says, if it's so safe and users see transactions, how did someone steal my son's bitcoins? Robin, a question we had from Clyde in New Orleans. How do you subdivide Bitcoin? We know what $1 or one Bitcoin is, but what's, like $1.99? What's a subdivision of Bitcoin called, Robin?
I actually don't know what a subdivision of Bitcoin is called, but I mean, with the value changing, it's incredibly difficult to really figure out how much necessarily you're spending. I mean, if you want to buy something, you know, worth $300, one day you'll have to use X number of Bitcoin, and the next day you'll have to use Y number of Bitcoin. And we ran a story about a couple who spent some time only living on Bitcoin. And I believe that was an issue for them, too. I mean, exactly how much are you spending and when? And it really varies from day to day. And I don't know, I can barely handle the change in my pocket. So I can just only imagine what that must be like.
This was the couple out of, I think, Provo, Utah, traveling the world on Bitcoin. They found groceries. They found places to stay or managed to barter or buy that. Had trouble finding gas, but finally did on Bitcoin. Andy, when it's $900 a Bitcoin, as it was this week, it's hard to pay for socks with that. How do you subdivide it?
Well, there is the smallest unit of a Bitcoin currently. I think that it's not a cent. This is actually much, much smaller. I think it's like a millionth or, you know, I don't even know how many. It's called a Satoshi, as a reference to Satoshi Nakamoto.
Okay.
And that's I believe that's the very smallest unit of Bitcoin you can have. And, you know, eventually the idea is that, you know, Bitcoin adherents believe that Bitcoins will be worth, you know, something like thousands or millions of dollars each, and then we'll be trading in Satoshis instead of full Bitcoins because that will be the meaningful unit of currency.
And what about Dread Pirate Roberts? I think you were the first to interview him, the guy who ran Silk Road where they sold so a lot of drugs. He held a lot of Bitcoin. Why did he go to Bitcoin? Was he happy with Bitcoin as a currency? And what happens to his Bitcoin now that he's in trouble?
Right. Well, a caller earlier said that Bitcoin came to light with WikiLeaks. I think it came to light more with the Silk Road in a way. The Silk Road was founded in early 2011. It only accepted Bitcoins in exchange for contraband of all kinds, but mostly drugs, and listed thousands of hard drugs, you know, including heroin, crack, cocaine, whatever. And the guy who ran the site called himself the Dread Pirate Roberts, and he was a real character. And in the Silk Road user forums, he would post these long political manifestos. He had a Dread Pirate Roberts book club about, you know, libertarian Austrian economics and things. Mm-hmm. And he did make an enormous amount of money. I mean, the FBI recently seized the Bitcoins that they believe belonged to him, and it was 144,000. I guess that would be I can't do the math.
It was like 100 million recently or more.
It'd be almost 100 million now, yeah.
Wow. Derek in Henderson, Kentucky. Derek, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My question is just based on taxes. The fact that we more or less, when it comes to yard sales, things like that, we spend cash or we buy or things are bought from us. We never charge taxes to these individuals. However, things that are regulated taxes, automobiles, cars, you know, homes, even
sure,
these would be tax regulated things. How would Bitcoin you know, if I pay for something with a Bitcoin or something's bought from me with Bitcoins, you know, how do I turn that in on taxes or even go to the DMV and try to get, you know, a license plate for my car?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Robin Seidel, how about it? I mean, the equivalent of sales taxes or, for that matter, capital gains taxes or, for that matter, inheritance, estate taxes. How does it work? Or does it?
That is a great question, and nobody knows. Everybody's trying to figure that out. And when Congress announced that they were going to have these hearings, they sought a lot of information from all kinds of government agencies, including the IRS. The IRS, as far as I know, hasn't said anything officially about that, but people are indeed talking about it. If you mine Bitcoin, is that a capital gain? You know, do you have to pay taxes on that? I have no idea what the answer is, but a lot of people are asking those questions, and it's really uncertain, but it's definitely increasingly an issue.
And remind us, Andy, why do the kind of libertarian, anti, let's say, Federal Reserve Bank folks particularly like Bitcoin? They think this is a way to break free?
Well, you know, I wrote a lot about this group called the Cypherpunks in the 1990s, mm-hmm, who believed that they could use cryptography to take power away from the government and give it to individuals in lots of ways. And one thing that they want to avoid is taxes. And they see Bitcoin, a lot of very radical users believe that Bitcoin is a way to avoid taxes altogether. Certainly the Silk Road, when it was selling heroin, was not, you know, collecting sales tax on that. So In a way, it's about avoiding inflationary currencies and economic ideas that I'm not actually that familiar with as a technology reporter. But it also is potentially just a true anarchic currency that tries to sidestep government altogether.
Let's go to one of our government elected representatives right now, the man who was at the heart or kicked off the hearings this week in Washington, Andy at Forbes and Robin Sadell at The Wall Street Journal. Please stand by. Senator Tom Carper of Delaware joins us now from Washington, chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, opened up hearings this week in Washington on Bitcoin and virtual currency. Senator Carper, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. You say Bitcoin is a major emerging issue. Why?
Did I really say that?
Well, you're quoted that way in the Wall Street Journal. I guess you did.
Well, it must be true.
Why? Is it not?
I don't know if it's the major emerging technology, but it's not something we can ignore. I'm reminded a little bit of the Internet, Tom. When it was first started, people thought of all the bad things that could come out of the Internet, and indeed a number of bad things have come out. I think not many people ever dreamed we'd be doing things over the Internet with video and music.
Yeah.
Financial transactions and the way we communicate and transact business across the world.
So you're an upside, sunny side guy on Bitcoin. Like what?
So, there's plenty of downside for that we've seen so far with Bitcoin and human trafficking, child pornography, drug, money laundering, tax avoidance. There's plenty to be concerned about. But there's also, from people who thought a lot more about this than I have, came before our hearing and before a committee and said, this could be actually helpful for the economy. This could actually be helpful for businesses. This could be helpful for consumers. And essentially said, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so right now, what our committee is trying to do is to just say, all right, this goes across a lot of different segments of our government. We need to be thinking about it rather broadly, whether it happened to be the Treasury Department, the SEC, and the Justice Department, the FBI. We need to get our heads around this technology and see what is good about it and, frankly, what is not, and figure out what we need to do in order to tamp down that which is bad and to be able to allow that which is good to blossom.
So what did you learn? I mean, we've got dollars and euros and yen and renminbi and PayPal. Here's Bitcoin. How would it be more helpful potentially for economies or businesses or consumers, Senator?
Some of the witnesses before us, Tom, indicated that a virtual currency like Bitcoin could speed up transactions, financial transactions. It could bring down the cost of those transactions. It could help people who live in parts of the world where their economies are a mess, maybe their currencies are a mess, and would enable them to have something that would be more workable for them. Will it work out that way? For sure, I don't think we know. But I think the idea is to see this is not something we can ignore, and we're not going to do that. And again, what we have to find out, and what I was encouraged by, was that there's the potential for a good deal more good than bad. And what we need to, apart from our witnesses, is for them to tell us and the legislative branch and the government, federal government, what we need to be doing, sort of an all hands on deck, executive branch, judicial branch, legislative branch, to ensure that the potential good is recognized and the potential bad is reduced.
You know, just the effect of your hearing sent it to an all-time high. I mean, at one point on one exchange, it was $900 per Bitcoin. What's the underlying value if you just holding a hearing can drive it to those sky-high heights, Senator?
Well, I had no idea. Well, we probably should have thought that something akin to this could happen. The FEC, Federal Election Commission, was asked whether or not they would consider allowing folks to make donations to campaigns in through Bitcoins. That was just a couple of weeks ago. And I think the answer, the FEC would say, well, we'll take this serious. We'll look it over. And I think that in itself offered some legitimacy to this technology and the idea of having a hearing that did not go, I suppose, badly. It was, I hope, a balanced hearing that said, there's good here, there's bad here, and let's do more good than bad. I think that gave some people some encouragement.
What are you hearing from your constituents in Delaware, Senator? Are they have questions about this? Is it beyond them? Are they hoarding Bitcoin?
If they are, they're not saying anything to me about it. When I worked out of Hawaii this morning before I jumped on a train to come to Washington, a lot of folks in Hawaii came up to me, talked to me about different things while I was working out. They never mentioned Bitcoin. They didn't mention my work on it. I had written a piece on the Abraham Lincoln, you know, the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg Addresses. And
They
were all over that, but man, not a word on Bitcoin.
What about your 401k if you've got one, or your IRA? You're going to put it in Bitcoin, sir?
What I try to do is put my savings in. We have something called a First Savings Plan, the federal government, and it's big mutual funds. And that way, I don't get accused for saving one stock or the other, and kind of keeps me neutral and let somebody else worry about those investments. Bitcoins, I'm probably not going there anytime soon.
We're glad you're playing it straight up. You sure moved the market this week just by turning the spotlight. Senator Tom Carper, U.S. Senator out of Delaware, thank you very much for being with us, Senator.
Thanks, Thomas.
Robin, that speed of transactions that he mentioned there, it could speed them up. Why does Bitcoin speed up transactions?
I think it depends on the kind of transaction you're talking about. I mean, anybody who has done a wire transfer knows that in addition to paying fees for that, it can often take a couple of days, depending on how much money you're sending, where you're going. You have to fill out all kinds of forms because the bank needs to do what they call know your customer. They have to abide by know your customer rules. It can be time consuming and it can be expensive, versus zapping a currency to someone else anywhere in the world and it's immediate. So that's one thing about the speed. But also, you know, merchants for a long time, I mean, for forever, have been really unhappy with the amount of money they pay for credit card and debit card transactions.
Sure.
And there are so many people that are trying to find ways to kind of disintermediate our traditional payment system with, you know, the Visas and MasterCards and American Express and all the middlemen in between and the banks. And, you know, Bitcoin enthusiasts think that this cuts out a lot of that and just makes the system much more efficient.
John in Chicago. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, guys. Hi, Robin. Great to be here. I just wanted to talk just real briefly about the safety of this network and about how users need to be as safe as possible. Earlier, you mentioned something about some kid getting his Bitcoin stolen. That has nothing to do with the Bitcoin network. It has nothing to do with people hacking the blockchain. It's all from a client perspective. You need to make sure that your computers are safe. You need to make sure that where you store your Bitcoins is not on a live network. If you have invested a lot in Bitcoin, put your Bitcoin wallet on cold storage, which is something like a computer that doesn't have network activity.
Yeah.
Anywhere that isn't online. I'm hearing a lot of talk about people denigrating Bitcoin because they've invested a lot and it's gotten stolen. Well, that's not Bitcoin's fault.
So find the equivalent of a vault here. Don't leave it out on the street by a parking meter.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Now, I'd like to say my name is not John and I'm not from Chicago
okay.
for this very reason.
Are you Satoshi Nakamoto, founder of Bitcoin, sir?
Yeah, right. If I was Satoshi, I would not be anywhere on the air.
And maybe not Dread Pirate Roberts either. But we take your point, John, and I appreciate your call very much. I mean, keep it safe. One more quick one here. Matthew in Burlington, Vermont. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to sort of weigh in on one trend that's emerging that Bitcoin is facilitating that I think is really important and really under-talked about, mm-hmm. which is sort of the transformation of the corporation. For the last 100 years, the kind of government-sponsored joint stock corporation has been the dominant economic institution in
yep.
our society,
yep.
With the state kind of enforcing contracts. But what we're seeing now is Bitcoin is allowing for the emergence of essentially like large, well-capitalized corporations that have no reliance on state enforcement of contracts. And we're seeing this most prominently in Bitcoin mining. What your guest described earlier was kind of how Bitcoin mining worked back in 2010, 2011.
Okay.
But it's now become extremely capital intensive. And so rather than individual miners, you're now seeing these large companies that actually have shares that are offered on Bitcoin-denominated stock exchanges and pay out their dividends in Bitcoin.
So it is kind of like gold money. You got to take a lot of capital investment to get out there and do it. Andy, where does this go? Are we headed for some Wild West where even corporate structures are changed by Bitcoin? Will, you know, the Friedrich Hegel and the Austrian economists sort of blow it all wide open on the back of Bitcoin? We're in a new kind of economy?
I think that, Bitcoin is going to be kind of like the internet. This thing that as it becomes mainstream is sort of sanitized, but then there will always be this corner of it that's sort of like the, you know, just as there is, you know, a dark part of the internet, the dark web, there will be a kind of dark part of Bitcoin, like the dark economy that Bitcoin allows. There is this kind of subculture within Bitcoin that wants to preserve its anonymous properties even as it becomes regulated. And
you say a sort of split in the Bitcoin world on that question.
Exactly, a subculture within the subculture.
Wow. Well, life is always interesting, isn't it? We're headed out into new territory here. The Winklevi right out there, and a lot more Congress all over it this week. My guests, Robin Seidel and Andy Greenberg as well. Robin Seidel with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for helping raise the curtain a little higher, a little wider on Bitcoin. Thanks for joining us, Robin.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And Andy Greenberg, great to have you with us, author of the This Machine Kills Secrets at Forbes. Andy Greenberg, thanks for your time and insights.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, the conversation goes on online, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.